podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome back to that Chelsea podcast, where Chelsea have drawn 0-0 against Aston Villa in the FA Cup and will go to an unwanted midweek replay. Yay! Joining me to look back on a frustrating, promising, encouraging, inevitable night at Stamford Bridge last night is Mr. Tom Curley. Tom, how are we doing on this Saturday morning?
I'm good, thanks. All of those words are absolutely true, and in some ways it's an encapsulation of Chelsea's season in just how promising at times it can look, but then also at the end of the day, if you don't score your chances, you don't win many games, and that's sort of been the Chelsea mantra for this season. So it was a good 0-0. I think you can describe that game as entertaining, and it was quite fast paced, and the game did seem to tick by pretty quickly, but the result is not ideal for either team, really.
And we will get onto that shortly. As all do guests, I get them to give themselves a plug. So Tom, tell people where they can find you and all your stuff.
Yeah, so all my written work, mainly at football.london, and also little bits for the Liverpool Echo and Manchester Evening News along the way. And then also at TomCurley49 on Twitter for general football and, at the moment, cricketing ramblings as the winter goes on.
Yes, Tom's links will be in the description below. Right, Tom, Chelsea FC Villa, before we get into the game, I thought it was probably the first 60-65 minutes is probably some of the best football we've played all season. We should have been two up maybe during that period of time. I then kind of think fatigue showed. You know, we played 3 days prior and Villa had basically a two-week break. And in the last 20-25 minutes, Villa probably could have gone on and won it if it were not for some, you know, impressive Jordi Petrovic saves, who we'll get onto later. It was just, there was a lot to like, especially, you know, given some of the circumstances of like a late injury just before the start of the game. But it did also, to me, feel like this felt potentially like our best chance of progressing through to the cup had gone. It, like, as much as like it was, I'm pretty pleased with the performance and we'll get onto that. There's also part of me going, we've got an unwanted replay at Villa Park, and I'm pretty sure Aston Villa haven't lost at Villa Park for like some crazy long amount of time. So it did feel like, as encouraging as a lot of that performance was, it just did feel like missed opportunity, and will we come to regret that? And unfortunately, I think we may do.
Yeah, I'm just looking at Aston Villa haven't lost at Villa Park since September, and that was in the Carabao Cup. Before that, you're going all the way back to February last year when they lost to Arsenal in that Jorginho game. I think the long and the short of it is exactly what you said at the top there. Chelsea were good for a large portion of the game. After a slow 10 minutes, you know, conceded the goal early on, disallowed for offside. I think the way that Chelsea responded to it, though, and really took control of Villa, I think that is probably the most controlled 60 minutes of football we've seen Chelsea. It's the best I think I've seen them since they played against Arsenal and were 2-0 up for 75 minutes. But in that game, a lot of the control was sort of off the ball, stopping Arsenal from progressing the ball. Whereas against Aston Villa, Chelsea dominated possession, had lots of the territory, and were, if not creating clear-cut chances, creating quite a lot of half chances against a really, really organised set up from Aston Villa. And that's no mean feat. Aston Villa are third in the Premier League for a reason. They are a really, really good side, really, really well organised. They know their strengths and they tend to be able to exploit other teams' weaknesses. It did feel like a missed opportunity, especially as Chelsea are at the moment so strong at home, unbeaten in 10, unbeaten this year, scoring goals at Stamford Bridge as well. And away from home, it's really, really quite woeful. So it's going to be a big, big challenge at Villa Park, albeit the last time we did go there, we did win, right? Under Graham Potter early on, about however long ago, 16 months ago. But in terms of this season, I think there's a chance that Chelsea can do this because Villa have got their eyes on Europe and they will want this replay no more than Chelsea do. I was looking it up yesterday. Chelsea, I think they're going to have ended up playing 8 games in the first 6 weeks of January compared to Arsenal, who are playing, I think, 4 games basically. So with the Carabao Cup semi-final and the replay now, it adds to Chelsea's workload and they haven't really had a winter break. But I think that can be a positive as well as a negative because I think yesterday we really saw, even though it was rotated at the back and up front, it looked like a really quite well-coached team, which isn't something you've always been able to say about Chelsea this season.
Yeah. Before we get into the game, Tom, we do obviously, where, as you mentioned, it has gone to a replay. I'm just going to get the replay chat out there now because this is basically just a very controversial topic. Whenever you bring it up on social media, and if you're, if you don't probably provide the careful caveats, then you will just get, slaughtered for basically saying you don't get it. Look at you, big club mentality, disregarding all the lower clubs. Tom, as you mentioned, neither side wants this replay. I think. Bold proposal, and I know people are going to be like, people will not be pleased with this because not all clubs will necessarily agree to replays. To which I say, yeah, but not all, but like some games in the rounds of the cup have VAR, some don't, so you're going to have complaints there. And I said, for example, if this game had been, against a championship Middlesbrough midweek and Middlesbrough got that goal would have stood anyway. Point being, I think if you're in the cup against a team from the same division, there should automatically be no replay. Just automatically. And then I think there should also be the additional option if you're not playing the team in the same division, that there is the option, if both sides agree beforehand not to take the replay, then there is no replay. I'm thinking more about, let's say, a Premier League and Championship side. But I think that's potentially less likely if it's Premier League and League One or something, or, Premier League and League Two. I think obviously that league, the lower league side would obviously take a replay. But just thoughts, I know it's not an ideal solution, but basically put, it just adds more games to a schedule. We already kind of moan enough about players getting flogged with the amount of football they play. And yes, we obviously retort to that is, well, you've got a squad, use your squad, etc. Yes, also injuries, etc. But to me, it just feels like the logical solution. And I don't know if it's next year replays are sort of getting axed or if it's a point replays are getting axed. I feel like every year is kind of talked about this is the year replays get axed, wherever from certain points. And I know from later rounds, replays get axed. But it just feels like nobody wants another game of this last night. And look, I'll be honest, I think I'd have rather gone to extra time last night, even if I do think it would have increased our chances of going out, just given the way the game state was going. I'd rather have got that done and out of the way last night than have to, get this in another midweek. And it's if it's, I think if it's potentially like a midweek, it's either the 7th or like the 21st. And that's, either way, it's going to be in between Prem games or a potential League Cup final during the time. I think it's more likely the 7th. So it's in between
I think it's the 7th,
Wolves
it's going to be the
and
10th.
Palace. So, like, again, neither of us. Like, those are two big games for Chelsea in their quest to move up the Premier League table as well. And Villa will have their eyes on qualifying for the Champions League just through league position anyway. So yeah, just long and short of it, there's not an ideal solution, but just thoughts on that idea that, on the replays.
I have no particularly strong thoughts on replays, but I know that I really don't want to watch more football like this. Like, I completely agree with you. I'm not 100% sure on the voting and how sort of having. I know you make the VAR point, which is a really good point, but I don't know how I would feel about clubs actually actively voting for and against replays on a sort of round by round basis, albeit before the is it before the fifth round anyway, and then they get scrapped, whatever. I do quite like the different divisions. Like keep replays for different divisions because as I say like nobody needs Chelsea versus Aston Villa. No, like the fans aren't that bothered. It's also the fact that it has to be in the midweek as well for fans. It's not optimal particularly, and the FA Cup is already used as this competition to sort of rotate teams. Maybe that's a good thing for squad players, but when you've got injuries and when you've got problems in sort of balancing and rotating your side anyway, it's really not ideal. I'm pretty relaxed on whatever they do with replays personally, but as I say, this doesn't benefit anybody. Is anybody really particularly excited? I would scrap it for the time completely, just as a concept. I quite like the cut and dry of the Carabao Cup, where if it's not over by 90 minutes, then you're going to penalties. It's quite ruthless, but extra time is so dull, so dull. And for me, it would actually promote sort of more attacking football towards the end of games, which I think is quite good. Because would you rather risk losing the game in normal time but go to the lottery of penalties, or would you rather, sort of chance your hand to win the penalties? I think that's quite an interesting debate to be had. Honestly, I'm quite on the fence with replays. If they got rid of it, I would be like, sure, I think that's fine. I think they do need to make a change right now, where they either make it like a divisional structure for replays, or they do the vote. I just think it can't go on that every game is definitively going to be a replay, because it's too much for a lot of teams.
Yeah,
And I mean,
indeed.
if you also think about like what Chelsea have got coming up, they've now got Liverpool on Wednesday. There are bigger games on the horizon than with Chelsea sort of just about knocking at the door now of like the top six. The last thing they really want is to have to think about going to a really, really intense and fired up Villa Park, and Villa Park will be exactly the same. They want to try and remain in the top four and push on in Europe. The last thing they want to do is the Chelsea side that are really keen to try and progress in the cup as well. So it might be a good game, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to keep.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And as I said, I would have much rather, as I said, the game either go straight to penalties yesterday, even if it meant we were placing penalty specialist Emi Martinez while we've got our own in Jordi Petrovic. That could have been quite a fun shootout. But also, I'm thinking, like, I just, I want to get it done. I just want to get it done, because it's just another game for Chelsea season. And realistically, now that replay probably just does take on less importance than, the original tie did, just due to when it falls a match. That is just unfortunate. Tom, as for the game itself, I was kind of fairly accepting of what was going to happen fairly early on, as well as Chelsea were playing. I literally said to multiple people, I said this message to numerous people, including yourself: fun watch, playing well, so I'm prepared for the inevitable. The inevitable did not happen, but it did become quite clear to me from, a point on, yeah, we're not scoring, and the best outcome for this is probably a replay. It was just frustrating. Let's talk about what was all three. I don't know if we're going to get Aston Villa that average again. Like the amount, like we talk about in the midweek, Middlesbrough playing out from back was poor, but this was an Aston Villa side who are levels above that side, and they were giving the ball away to us in poor areas, and we didn't capitalize, and that was really frustrating. And I guess it's also really frustrating, but that's probably, and it's not to, single out blaming him, but Cole Palmer's probably the second time in a few weeks, but he's been presented sort of these opportunities, and he has not taken them, which is,
I
yeah,
guess.
which is a bit frustrating.
I mean, but I guess, and I get your point, and sort of some of the chances, Cole Palmer getting the ball on the edge of the box twice and getting a shot away, is you can't bank on that happening in the second leg. But Villa also can't bank on giving Cole Palmer half that sort of chance and him not scoring. So I think Villa will also say we really, really got away with one there. And I think Chelsea deserve credit for that, because it reminded me a little bit of the Brighton tie in the Carabao Cup, where we came into it on a bad run of form and everyone was sort of like, we're going to lose here. And Chelsea won. And that was genuinely a surprise at that time. And I think yesterday, I think people probably expected to lose to Aston Villa. Maybe not after beating Middlesbrough and with the home form. But I think there were probably justifiable. Aston Villa were just about evens for that game, if not probably favourites going into it, given their break. So to come away with a draw and to have not exactly been hanging on, I think Chelsea were bought their luck maybe towards the end of the game, defended well-ish. I mean, Petrovic had to make two good saves. Villa just upped it and were able to really take command of the game, whereas Chelsea subs didn't, something I think we'll come on to. Going to Villa Park will be really, really tough. There's no doubt about that, but I think we have seen improvements in Chelsea over the past couple of weeks to suggest that actually there's nothing really to fear, because losing to Villa at Stamford Bridge earlier in the season and losing to Newcastle are the outliers of what has been some really strong performances against the top sides in the league. And that run of Arsenal, Tottenham, Manchester City all came, and I think that performance against Villa that we saw last night was sort of comparable to that in the way that Chelsea took the game to Villa and controlled the possession for large periods and really asserted themselves on the game, both on and off the ball. The way that Gallagher and Palmer pressed from the front relentlessly was really, really impressive. Caicedo deeper, and the sort of bravery of, I think, of De Zazzi and Badiashile and Gilchrist all stepping up to really not give Villa time to play through the midfield. I thought that was all really good and things that can absolutely be taken into Villa Park. Chelsea might not get chances as good as the ones that Cole Palmer took in the replay, but I think given that we've seen Palmer score from chances much harder than that, there has to be belief actually that this game isn't over and that Chelsea can be more than a match for this Villa side.
Yeah, Tom, we obviously kind of suffered a blow before the match even started when Levi Colwill was ruled out of starting, and that meant Alfie Gilchrist came in and started. He got 60, 65 minutes. Tom, arguably the biggest game of his Chelsea career so far, the biggest test of his Chelsea career so far, and I thought, just really solid. Just really solid,
Yeah.
didn't necessarily have to do, didn't do anything too crazy, was not necessarily, bombing forward, etc., but was just solid defensively and basically did. It was handed a tough task against a tricky and good Villa attack, and he did well and kept them at bay. And that was just really encouraging. And it's been encouraging that in this last month or so that Alfie Gilchrist has emerged as someone that Mauricio Pochettino can turn to in these situations.
Yeah, absolutely. I was doing some work, sort of writing about the team that I would have picked for the game and that I sort of expected Pochettino to pick for the game. And I did leave Gilchrist out, even though in a cup game, perhaps this is perfect for him. It's a little bit of a free hit almost for Gilchrist. They're like, if Chelsea lose and Gilchrist is in the team, it's not like the worst thing ever. When he came in, though, I was absolutely fine with sort of what happened on the pitch. I thought he was really, really impressive. He stepped out quite a lot into the midfield and really put pressure on. He stepped out with the ball. He came in centrally with the ball as well. And considering that Preston targeted his side quite a lot in the third round, I thought he put up a really good showing against a much better opposition. And the fact that it was him that came off for Ben Chilwell is no slight on him, but more just the sort of fact that De Zazzi going back, going to right back, and everything sort of changing around just made sense basically at that stage of the game. And it is really, really nice actually that Pochettino has got Gilchrist into this side, because it's a role you think might have been filled potentially by someone like Trevor Chalobah, given their sort of overlap in roles and ability to play on the right-hand side. It's really, really good for Gilchrist. It is good for moving forward with the academy. And I know people get angry at the sort of lack of time given to Cobham players, but I think given what Pochettino's had to deal with over the first 6 to 8 months of his Chelsea career, the fact that it's taken this long to get Gilchrist in is fine, basically. And he's now part of this squad and he's becoming a really useful member. He's the finisher effectively in games usually. But to see him put up a strong performance there is really, really good. And it means that Chelsea do have options both from the bench and from the start in games if Gusto ever needs to play left back or anything like that. And maybe it will reduce the strain on Colwill because he's played a lot of football this season. He's played a lot of football in an unnatural position, so I'm not really surprised that he picked up an injury. It was really nice to see.
Yeah. So I'm also like a quick one. There were perhaps more stand-up players, but I thought Benoit Badiashile were actually playing a really, pretty solid shift the other day, considering, that he'd not been in the side for it and we had seen his sort of struggles when he had come back into the side. I thought, just a side point, he's been out of the side for a while, not really been involved as much, but that was just a nice, solid performance when he was on the pitch.
Yeah, there was one moment when I think he sort of almost tripped over the ball a little bit Newcastle-like.
And then he gave Bia Watkins that chance for Petrovic to save, wasn't it? Yeah. But aside
But
from that,
playing out of position, he doesn't look the most natural left back, but that's not surprising. I thought they might have put like De Zazzi at left back and kept Badiashile in the middle, but I don't think there's any ideal answer when you're playing with four centre backs in the team. I mean, most of Villa's play sort of came on the break and came on the left in that first half specifically, more towards Gilchrist. So I think Badiashile was solid. He's not going to overlap. He's not going to bomb on. Then again, neither does Colwell. I think it's just reassuring that something like that didn't cost Chelsea the game or anything like that. I mean, when Ben Chilwell came on, I know we spoke about this, there wasn't really much different, wasn't much change. I can't remember a time where Chilwell got into the Villa half himself. So it was solid enough and, did well in the air in the end because Villa had looked threatening from set pieces throughout the entire game.
Yeah, indeed. Tom, go on, just not, but Moises Caicedo, like, again, I just feel like we're almost getting to this thing, and it, without trying to get, too hyperbolic, it is almost sort of like, it almost feels like we're getting to sort of like, almost like Kante, just like, oh yeah, Kante, even we go like Kante, standard, like, solid, good game. Like, there were, more players' performances who you kind of know so stand out. And that's not to say Caicedo is anywhere sort of at the level NG was, but it just does feel sealed for the last month or so. We've just basically been saying, bar, not tracking his runner at Middlesbrough away. Well, we've basically just been saying with Moises Caicedo, just like a really good game, sort of just going under the radar a bit. And yeah, I'm not, the narrative around him from the some media and other sort of sections of fan bases, but he's kind of, about that signing aside, like it's just been like Moises Caicedo over the last month and a bit, so he just really showed his value to this Chelsea team, hasn't he? Like, again, just yesterday, just a really solid performance.
Yeah, he's been really quite good now, as you say, for between 4 to 6 weeks, probably a little bit longer. And it's really easy for sort of wider media and wider fans to point the finger and say, "What is he doing?" Well, if you're not noticing Caicedo in a game, I think he's doing his job. In general, he's not the sort of keystone to a team playing out of the back because that's not how Chelsea use him. And I think at times yesterday, there were points where both Fernandes and Caicedo were taking up similar positions. So that's why I'm not as against Fernandes being higher up as most people are, because they can sort of step on each other's toes sometimes. And you don't need, even against a good pressing team like Villa, you don't need two players comfortable on the ball to play out like that in a pivot. You don't need that. Not many teams have that. So getting Fernandes further up is good. I've been really impressed with how Caicedo and Gallagher play together, because they just have the legs to cover the ground in midfield, and then it can allow Palmer to play in the 10, and you get sort of an extra attacker. And when Chelsea are playing against your sort of lower blocks, I think that's something that can really, really be exploited in the future. Just really solid, and I know the comparison you mean with Kante, and I know that you don't mean it in a way of he is Kante, right? But it is just that sort of, yeah, he was really good again, and you feel like you should bring it up because there is this narrative around him not being good enough, not being worth the price tag. It's not really about that. How good is his performance? Like, forget the price tag. Let's ignore that completely. And it's been really, really nice actually that Chelsea have been able to get the most out of him or start to get the most out of him in recent weeks. And going under the radar is absolutely fine. I think he won't mind that either. He's been really important to what's been going on.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Tom, kind of guess a sort of another standout, and certainly the standout, certainly that last 20, 30 minutes, Jordi Petrovic. I know when you were on for the season preview show, you were a lot bigger on Robert Sanchez than a lot of Chelsea people were. But
Don't
I
bring it
think
up. Come on.
even you, as someone who was, was fairly, upbeat on the Robert Sanchez signing, but I said Petrovic has surely secured the number one berth for now anyway. Immediately, he has not put a foot wrong in a Chelsea shirt, and he's made, some big, big saves in this last, again, this sort of last, in this period since Robert Sanchez has been out.
Yeah, no, Petrovic has been brilliant. I mean, outside of that Everton, the Everton goal where he flapped at a corner. Come on, it's his first game. He's away at Goodison Park. We're already 1-0 down. I think he's been really, really good. There was perhaps the Middlesbrough goal at the end of the game. He'll be annoyed to have conceded from where he did, considering some of the other saves he made. But at the end of the day, it didn't really matter. I think he's still got to be more commanding with set pieces, and he does struggle a little bit with crosses. But in terms of shot stopping, he's been really, really solid. I mean, there was the shot first half, was it? No, second half, was it Douglas Luiz who hit one in and it sort of came through some bodies and Watkins looked like he might sort of make a move to go for the ball. And Petrovic had to react late to it, but he held the ball so solidly. And I thought that's a really underrated save. He's not sprawled away and dived away and parried it and tipped one in from the top corner, but it's just a really, really solid piece of goalkeeping. And there was the Watkins save in the second half as well at his near post. And then the one from Matty Cash is just It's really, really good goalkeeping. And on the ball, he's not as good as Rob Sanchez. He doesn't take the risk that Sanchez does, and Chelsea don't get the benefit of playing out from the back that you get with Sanchez. But he's got clarity in what he's doing. If the ball comes back to him and he doesn't feel comfortable enough to make a pass, he will just get rid of it. And I think even in this sort of world of people getting used to what the expectations of goalkeepers are, it's quite reassuring to see someone not take risks that they're not comfortable enough to make. And for a goalkeeper that has come in unexpectedly in the last 2 months, he's been really good. And everything we sort of hear about Petrovic is positive from within the club, from people that have coached him, from people that have watched him in America. People expected him to become the Chelsea number one, perhaps not like this, but everyone seemed to suggest that Petrovic could very much go on to become the number one. And I think this is his spot to lose. It's unfortunate for Sanchez, who I don't think had done loads wrong before going out. But Petrovic has, in the short term, he's been an upgrade. I think he's saved Chelsea more goals than Sanchez would have in the same position. And he brings confidence. I know Deb on Twitter describes him as an albatross, basically just because he's got a wingspan. And having watched Kepa and continue to watch Kepa highlights from his time at Real Madrid, it's really reassuring that Petrovic just makes things look easier because he's taller, right? And that's just the very nature of it. I've been really, really impressed with him so far. And as a goalkeeper, I really like what we see in terms of how clearly he thinks, in terms of kicking the ball away. And then when it comes to making saves, he's made some big, big saves. So he's been really impressive so far, better than I thought he would be. And I'm happy to be proven wrong on Rob Sanchez, by the way. I just wanted to give a little bit of balance to that argument.
Yeah, no, fair. And look, what I would say is, all the praise for Robert Sanchez is playing out from the back. I think he had also, I think it's fair to say, left our Chelsea fans quite scared with some of his passing out from the back. And unfortunately for him, there have been quite a few notable examples of him giving away. But yeah, no, obviously I get you. Petrovic is sort of perhaps, if in doubt, hoof it out type mentality. But I don't mind that from my goalkeeper. That's what I get for growing up in the 2000s with Petr Cech goal. So it's normality restored, and to a sense, Thibaut Courtois as well.
He
In
reminds me
the
of,
mid 2000s and tens.
yeah, no, there's no problem with that either, by the way. And I really like, it reminds me a little bit of Rudiger, because Rudiger always had this sort of, yes, he was brilliant on the ball and he could rampage up the pitch, but he would also sometimes lump it out of West London if he needed to, and he would put the ball to the moon just to get it gone sometimes. Even if he didn't really make up the territory, he would just slam it into the stands, to relieve some pressure. And Petrovic sort of does that. He's not aiming to do it, obviously, necessarily. He wants to get the ball further down the pitch, keep it in play. But it's just reassuring to know that he doesn't feel the pressure to have to play every single time. And that's a big thing for a goalkeeper, to not get these mixed messages.
No, indeed, it's been a very good period for Jordi Petrovic. Tom, obviously, there were missed chances. Nonny, has a shot saved by Martinez. We obviously know Palmer, has a couple of ones. Also, found what's quite frustrating is I just feel that in is a point that listeners will hear at the end of the show when Gabs gives his thoughts, as always. But it's kind of things that Chelsea, well, I found Chelsea, we always just shoot so low at Emi Martinez. It's like we always shoot at his feet. I find it just like quite frustrating, like in these two games we've seen against them, and perhaps even going back to the game we lost under Pozzo last year, we always go low against Martinez, and he's rather good down low with his feet in there, just a fall. But no, Chelsea have those opportunities and were fairly wasteful. Tom, obviously, I think it does sort of turn the last period of time. I think in that period, unfortunately, the subs did not work, and we'll kind of get onto it now. Because as we said, when we were messaging, after the game yesterday, we don't remember Mudryk touching the ball. And then on the other hand, unfortunately, we do remember Armando Broya touching the ball. It was a very, very bad touch when he could have potentially been racing for a goal, and instead it went out for a goal kick. I'll tell you the
Quite a
two unfortunate
Mudryk-like
stuff.
touch, actually.
Tom, is I guess and there's a maybe question, we'll get onto it later. When you kind of, I'm trying to think how to phrase it. Is, I guess, can we kind of maybe see why potentially Poch is at times not as, Poch can maybe be a bit justified in sort of waiting for his subs a bit. And I know it does tend to frustrate people, but you look at who comes on yesterday, and I don't think Chile really was able to impact the game much. I also think Chile's substitution, rearranging sort of positions of a back line, probably didn't help loads. Obviously, get Gilchrist being the one to come off for Chile, but the sub logically I may as well, but I think it does push off a back line. But it did, I did also find it quite telling that Sterling, again, as frustrating as he was at points last night, with wanting too many touches and holding on to the ball that bit too long, it did, the noticeable drop off in quality when those subs came on last night was rather telling, with Mudryk and Armando coming on the 77th minute. It did feel quite noticeable, that drop in quality, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that it was a change made out of being tired rather than actually thinking necessarily these players could impact the game. Logically, it made sense to bring on Breuer to try and get someone a little bit bigger and a little bit quicker into that position. But we've seen Breuer isn't necessarily the sort of difference maker from the bench. He's not playing with that confidence. I think the one change maybe you could have made would have been Chukwuemeka, but given Aston Villa were really on top of the game at that point, do you want to take off any of the midfielders? Probably not. Like Gallagher would be the one you take off, maybe Fernandes. And that's just a little bit of quality you lose when you bring on Chukwuemeka. Nothing against Chukwuemeka. So I think it was tough for Pochettino yesterday. I mean, the average age of the bench was less than 21. There were quite a lot of players on there that haven't played any football in general, let alone, let alone this season. And I just think that it became harder for Chelsea to get in the game when the subs came on because they weren't really in the game at that stage anyway. They'd already been sort of holding out and struggling to assert themselves for about 15 minutes before the subs came. And I think they came, as I say, more out of legs and fitness than trying to change the game and get themselves in the game. I mean, Mudryk was genuinely woeful against Middlesbrough, so that I didn't have much confidence that he would make much difference here. And the risk is that you're never quite sure what you're going to get with him off the ball either. And against Aston Villa, if you switch off and one of their wingers runs past him, or you get one of their fullbacks again that sort of runs past him and he lets him go, that is a risk that you don't really want to take. And we don't, Madueke I thought was lively, but again, like, end product just doesn't really exist. So if Palmer's not scoring the goals for Chelsea, who's scoring the goals? And it was a problem, but I don't think Pochettino had too many options personally. I don't think if he'd made subs at 65 minutes or 70 minutes, it would have made any real difference, particularly. So I think Chelsea did well in the end to sort of not salvage a draw from that game, but to sort of get through the game with a draw in the end, having missed the chances to go ahead. I don't really know what I'm getting at here. I didn't have a problem with
Yeah,
the subs. I didn't think
no,
we had
I kind of
necessarily the
get what you're
options from the
saying.
bench.
Yeah, I feel like that game, if that game was earlier on in the season, we'd have ended up losing that game. I think
It
that
did.
is sort of
Yeah,
a bit
it
of a
did feel like
development in
that
this side.
because we were good at, I think we were pretty good against Villa in the home game when we lost, and we created numerous chances. Sterling had another of those, could have squared it, but decided to shoot lower. Emi Martinez, and then sort of Watkins scores on the break. So when Matty Cash went through and sort of cut inside and had that shot, I sort of thought that is literally the Watkins goal. Like there it is again for us. So I think Chelsea did well to sort of like get themselves some resilience in that sense. And you've got to remember where Chelsea are building from.
Yeah, no, indeed. It meant, it's 10 unbeaten at Stamford Bridge, which again is just nice. But you, there is a sense that as tricky as I knew the tie was last night, I did have confidence. I was going, well, we've got good home form now. We've got good home form. There's reason to be confident we can do it. And I guess the next step is improving that away form. And I think five of our next six are away. So I guess that would be a big test of Poch and this team. Going to move on to listener questions to further the conversation. And Tom, the first question comes in from someone you know rather well, Mr. Luca Foley, who's has a number has a couple of questions. Firstly, could you see this result coming tonight as soon as you saw we weren't starting a striker? Now, Luca, I did sort of kind of answer this a little bit earlier. I wouldn't say as soon as I saw we weren't starting a striker, but I did send to numerous people at half time that I kind of had a feeling how this one ended, and obviously we did not end up losing it, but it became quite clear to me. And when I think Palmer misses Fluff that second chance, second or third chance, well, when it was about the 60-65 minute, I was like, yeah, we're definitely not scoring today. That's when I resigned to knowing we were not winning. Tom, how about you? When was the moment? Because I think maybe not starting a striker was a tiny bit, for Luke's question, maybe a tiny bit presumptuous. Because again, with great respect to Armando Broya and someone who's, perhaps bigger on it on him than others, he has basically shown nothing during this period where Nicholas Jackson's away. And Tom, sidebar, when you were last on, we went to the staunch defence of Nicholas Jackson. And I think this last month has not only has kind of justified our view for, being such strong backers of him, given what we have seen, and the fact that in his absence, we have had a couple of games. Well, we've had two games where Chelsea have failed to score, and also a game against Fulham in the Premier League, which relied on us getting a penalty to score. As flawed as, again, this is just a side point to Lucas, as flawed as Chelsea are, and as flawed as Nicholas Jackson is, we do miss him, don't we? And then just go back to answering Lucas' question.
I stand by everything I said about Nicholas Jackson before and will continue to. I spoke about him on the Blue Crew podcast last week, and I made some pretty out, I don't know if it's outlandish. I said that Nicholas Jackson will go on to be a much better striker than Ivan Toney, and I don't think that's particularly controversial because Jackson could pass Toney's non-penalty goals. His best non-penalty goal season this season. He needs five more goals to match Toney. That's completely one of the point. I really like Nicholas Jackson. Yes, we have seen that Breuer has not exactly taken his chance. There's a lot of raw materials there, but we don't really see anything from him necessarily. I don't particularly like Luca's question, sorry to say it, Luca, because I think a lot of what gained Chelsea those earned Chelsea those chances was not having a striker. I think the pressing from Palmer and Gallagher, like Chelsea had against Arsenal in the 2-2 draw, was fundamental towards Chelsea creating a lot of the chances and getting a lot of the high turnovers and making the runs in behind the defence that they did. It was the fact that both, it's the catch-22 of having no striker. You can be freer and create more chances and you're a lot more fluid in attack, which we saw from Chelsea, especially in the first half, but then you do miss the focal point to put the ball in the net and it's Nani Madueke rather than, I don't know, Karim Benzema that's in the middle of the box. Or, have we seen anything from Armando Broya to suggest that he would have scored if he had taken any of those chances? I don't think so. I don't really think so. What did you say? The net benefit or the gross benefit you get of having Broya in the team? I don't necessarily see it. Chelsea created more than enough chances to win that game without a striker or without a natural number nine. And considering Cole Palmer is Chelsea's best attacker, best finisher, best creator, handing him, putting him in a position where he creates some chances, but also gets handed those chances via his pressing largely, that is not necessarily a bad thing. So, no, I didn't necessarily see the nil-nil coming. I thought it was going to be tough for Chelsea to create as many chances as they did before the game, especially when you're playing four centre backs and then one of those goes off injured before the game. So I was positively surprised and really pleased with the way that Chelsea performed for those opening 45 minutes and the opening 60, 65 minutes in general. I didn't think Chelsea would get to that level last night. So for them to do that regardless, I thought was really, really good actually. And I'd rather see it that way than say, oh, there was no striker, we were never going to score. Because outside of Jackson, and people will have their questions over Jackson, there's no proof that anyone in this Chelsea squad scores those goals. Maybe Chilwell. You need Chilwell or James to take those chances. They're probably the second or third best strikers of a ball. Probably the first and second best strikers of the ball at the club still. So that would be my point. Chelsea don't have a striker that I think makes that much of a difference in that scenario.
Yeah, and obviously we saw Armando start midweek and, saw that one chance he did get actually ends up taking a bit too long and Johnny Howson beats him to it and just bundles it into the net. And he was pretty
It's a bit
ordinary
like the Fulham
midweek
one.
against Middlesbrough. Tom, Lucas' second question. And what does the future hold for Armando Broya? I'll be honest, this month he has not really pressed his case at all at Chelsea. It's a shame because, you know, I think that injury has obviously just had quite a big impact on him. Tom, I asked it on a couple of pods ago, I think. You know, there are links to a certain Mr. Karim Benzema. Does the appeal of Karim Benzema grow stronger every game that we see either a, you know, Chelsea player without a recognised number nine or start with Armando Broya?
I'm very conflicted on this matter, and I've made the point for and against Benzema. I don't really know where I stand. The fan in me is like, yes, we need Karim Benzema right now. He would make a big difference to Chelsea. The sort of writer in me would say, what number one, I think there have to be reservations over how good Benzema is still. I think he didn't play, he played in less than 50% of Real Madrid's league games in the end of 2023, albeit he scored hat tricks in most of them. And he's been playing basically no level of football for the past 6 to 8 months. He is going to cost an almighty amount of money, even if he takes a 90% wage cut. Is Karim Benzema actually going to be the difference between Chelsea and getting the Champions League? No, he's not. Chelsea aren't going to get in the Champions League no matter what they do. Is it worth not selling your soul, but going all out for Karim Benzema to maybe get to sixth? I don't know. I don't know if that's worth it. I would rather spend the next 6 months trying to see exactly what Chelsea have in Jackson and Breuer. Especially Jackson, because we know he's going to stay. I think Armando Broya gets sold, probably not this window. I think it's too late, but probably over the summer. I don't know where he goes. I know I think I echo what Liam Toomey's been saying a lot this week about the fact that Chelsea are going to struggle to sell players, and especially someone like Broya, because if you want big money for Broya, you have to look at who's actually going to buy him. And he's not shown anything to prove that he's a £50 million striker, right? Or even close to that. But you're looking at 35 million. I know there's a question coming up about a certain Aston Villa Colombian striker that didn't play last night. And I'll try and avoid overlapping the two questions. The future for Armando Broya is away from Chelsea, it seems. I do wonder who the replacement is, though, because I don't know if you get somebody stacks better than Breuer for your 30-35 million pounds. I don't really know that. I've been a massive defender of Breuer. I really like him. I think there's the raw materials of a really strong striker. The injury has put a spanner in the works because we're still sort of waiting for him to get there. And every time he plays this season, it is sort of with the caveat of, oh yeah, but he's not really played that much football and he's coming back from this injury. And when he has played, he's been, you know, going on to rescue a game. And I just wonder how long you keep that up. How long can you keep saying, oh yeah, but there's this with Breuer, oh yeah, but there's that with Breuer, without seeing much at all from him? I mean, that Fulham game was really disappointing. He really didn't do much. Middlesbrough, sure, he was part of a team that won 6-1, but he wasn't central to it. I mean, De Zassi did more in the attacking curve than sort of Breuer did. So it's really unfortunate, but it's the way that sort of world football is going, and that selling Breuer has more value to Chelsea than keeping Breuer. And it's disappointing to say that, but I think that is probably the way it's going to go. What do you think?
Well, what I would say, Tom, you talk about Chelsea 1-1. If Chelsea, it's looking back now, the prime time for Chelsea to cash in on Armando Broya was after his loan spell at Southampton, because that's the best version of Armando Broya that people have seen. And you looked at his catalogue of goals that he scored there, albeit, you know, it was not loads, but I think it was about six or something, which wasn't bad. And you kind of did see, you know, a player there. Yeah, I think ultimately, I mean, it depends. I'm going to be honest, Tom. If you said to me, you offload Breuer this January, you get Benzema on a 6 month loan, I take it. I gamble and then I then trust Chelsea to then get that striker, that next choice correct in the summer. Because let's be clear, if Benzema comes in, I don't think he's starting every game for Chelsea. I do not think, you know, have him in to start every game. And I think Nicholas Jackson still a lot of games. But Tom, I'm just gonna, you know, throw there. We've got Liverpool in the cup final. Karim Benzema knows a thing or two about playing Liverpool and knows a thing or two about cup finals. And is it worth spending an unabsorbed amount of fees to help him get us over the line to win a domestic cup? Well, I mean, frankly, given our Wembley curse, then yes, given our recent record at Wembley and the pain that stadium has caused me in recent years, then absolutely yes. Could he be the man to help us get past Aston Villa, a replay against Aston Villa? Yes. Could he have been the man last night to get us through that tie of those chances? Potentially, yes. I don't think this is going to happen. This is all just, fantasy stuff. But that is why I'm perhaps more bigger on Benzema than most. And I'd be willing to take that gamble because I don't think we necessarily have a striker. And I know people, I've seen people compare it to Gonzalo Higuain. My difference with that is that Gonzalo Higuain, I think, had not, had obviously not reached the levels Benzema had. But also at Chelsea at the time, they did actually have a striker in Olivier Giroud and bizarrely chose not and bizarrely underutilized him that season with him. And he was, and where he was just utilizing the Europa League. And it's kind of telling the biggest two games of Chelsea that season, side point, the Europa League final, Giroud start, and all that Europa League run, Giroud starts. Higuain, I think, only has a 15-minute spell off the bench against Frankfurt in extra time in the semi-final second leg and does nothing. And their Carabao Cup final, which Higuain doesn't start. It's Hazard false nine. And it's like, oh, the fun times of that. Anyway, I digress. That's why I get the issue when people compare to Higuain because Higuain basically actually came in and wasn't trusted or was, and this is by someone who coached him and worked with him previously, wasn't really trusted. Whereas I think Benzema, yes, I think he's, perhaps on the decline a bit, and it is typical Chelsea to get a striker once their prime years are behind them. See numerous examples, but I'd be willing to go for it because also, and I know there may be questions about Karim Benzema, the person himself. I get all that, all the baggage that goes around him. But I would like to think that maybe he would see it. He's never played in the Premier League. Could he kind of think, okay, this is something I want to challenge myself with? I don't know. I said this is all fancy stuff. He's not happening. And yeah, as for Broglie, yeah, Tom, I think he stays. I think he stays in January, and I think he's probably gone in the
Yeah,
summer because
I don't think Broglie goes now. I don't think there's a way. I
exactly.
think
And
I do
also,
tend
I
to agree with you
think.
that if you could, if Chelsea were offered right now selling Broglie for 35 million and signing Benzema for 6 months before going and splashing the money on Osimhen, because let's face it, they're going to put up a fight for it. I don't think that would be the most stupid thing in the world. I have
Yeah, that's where I
reservations,
was going.
but I
I
don't.
have my reservations about signing Victor Osimhen, but I think that's their plan to try
I
and go
think.
get him in the summer.
I think as well that this is the natural pessimism of a Chelsea fan and someone around the Chelsea circle at the moment is that you don't have that much trust in any decision basically being right, especially not when it comes to massive, massive money and especially not when it comes to strikers. So it's only right that you are sort of sat there going, oh God, what if we were to sign Benzema and we didn't make it work? We would be that team that hasn't made it work.
Yeah, and also I think talking about signing a striker and in just general, I think that can then also link onto a later question as well. But yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I basically my rule is if Chelsea spend more than about 35 million on a player, I'm generally pretty skeptical because that's kind of a ballpark figure of what would where signings work out. I look at the signings that have been, obviously I think Moises Caicedo has definitely broken that rule so far, and Enzo Fernandez, I think even if people question him a bit, has probably broken that rule so far. But I look at Chelsea's best signings, Malo Gusto, Cole Palmer. Okay, granted, he's a bit over 35 mil, he's 40 mil, but like
Fabian
those two
Schuurs,
signings are
Nicholas
exactly,
Jackson.
but even to an extent, Axel Disasi, even if it was did feel at the time and maybe still does feel a bit of an unnecessary signing, he's obviously still playing a lot. Those kinds of signings I'm a bit more confident in. But yeah, we'll move on to our next question. Next question, and it continues sort of the striker discussion, comes in from Dean Mears. Not match related, but does trying to sign a striker that can't displace Ollie Watkins show a lack of ambition? Now, Dean, I'm not sure it shows a lack of ambition. I think it shows a flaw in strategy, to be honest. And I think that's probably being quite kind, Tom.
Yeah.
John Duran, whatever people think of him, whatever they've seen of him, and there's clearly a player there, from the bits people will have seen of him this season, but I think it's kind of a flaw in your strategy when you do not have a proven striker at Chelsea anyway. You're then willing to go, well, we'll go take a punt on another unproven striker who's going to need game time, but you also have another unproven striker there who needs game time. You've then also got your other striker from your academy who's basically offered the same output as Mr. John Duran this season, who you've then got a decision to make. And look, as we said earlier, you could cash in on Armando Broglie, but this is where I just kind of get frustrated with a model because to me, it just looks like you get Armando off the books, You get pure profit in the bank, fine. You then splash on John Duran and it's, say, what, 30 mil? And you give him a contract and you amortize that cost over a number of years and you go, okay, but financially it makes sense. But what you're not moving the needle one bit in your squad. And it kind of feels like that's kind of just where I found it so frustrating and bizarre. You're not signing a striker who's a regular at another team. You're signing a backup at another team anyway. Then you're also basically, all you're doing is basically just improving your situation financially
Yeah, you are
by
player trading. That is it, isn't it?
recently. You're just, exactly. That's what it is. Exactly. Player trading. That's what it is. It just seemed just so pointless. Like, I don't doubt that John Duran could be a good player. And granted, us signing him would have given me the opportunity to make a very bad Duran Duran reference, over, the time of the podcast with reference. But really, there was just, there's never any point. And, thankfully he's injured and it's not going to happen. But that just seemed so bizarre. And I think that's where people get frustrated with kind of the model and strategy that Chelsea have in place. But like, it's all well and good wanting to get these young players, etc. But there does, but the actual squad building element kind of seems to be missing. Like, I get, the idea of getting all these young talents, but the whole idea of actually then putting them, assembling a squad and putting them all together seems to be the final part that is lacking in this strategy, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and it becomes really hard to get excited about signings of young players. And I, pod favourite David Washington. Well, what happens to him, considering he's just sort of been kept around and not been able to use an
Well,
international loan
just
spot
a
this
David
season?
Datro Fafana who was signed in January last year and is on his second loan of the season.
And albeit I know it's going to work out financially because David Datra Fafana doesn't have to play much football to be worth £10 million because he's been signed by Chelsea. He will be accounting profit. The same will go for Diego Moreira, signed for free. Chelsea will make profit on him. How much? It doesn't really matter, but it will happen. It just really reduces the sort of effect of a signing. And this is the way modern football's going. This is the way Chelsea are going to be run. But I don't particularly like it that much. I hope, but have serious doubts over when Chelsea, if Chelsea get back into the Champions League and their revenues are boosted and new sponsorships come in and all of this stuff, I wonder if the player trading will take a backseat or if it will still be a big driver because then there's just the chance to make even more revenue, even more money. That's the model side of things. To go back to what you said earlier, like the gross benefit of selling Royer, but signing Duran is minimal, if any. It's unproven. You don't know. Maybe Duran could be brilliant. I think he's quite nice. I think he's got the raw materials again to be a really quite a good Premier League player. But if you're banking on raw materials, why not bank on the set that you've got tied down to a massive contract? Chelsea put Breuer on this contract last year. As you say, the best time to sell him would have been last summer for 30 million. But that was coming off the back of a really nice loan where everyone thought, hold on a second, this guy can really play for Chelsea. Maybe he would have. Maybe the injury changes everything. But I can understand why fans are so frustrated with this because Duran is so far away from what Chelsea need right now. And okay, maybe people can get over if you basically flip Breuer to sign Duran. But when you're so clearly in the need for somebody like Benzema in the short term, even like Giroud in the short term, when you get linked with number one a loan for Duran, number two a loan which might not have an option to buy, and then number three swapping in for Breuer, that's where there's mixed messages. That's where people will start getting concerned. And that's why I think Dean has probably labelled this a lack of ambition because it doesn't move the needle. It just says we're almost happy to make this change to bank on it potentially working in however long. And that isn't what people want to see. People want to see Chelsea in a cup final. Chelsea are in the FA Cup fourth round, might be in the fifth round very soon. They're in ninth, but on the verge of being around sixth. We're going to go and sign John Duran. Hold on, I would rather Chelsea didn't do anything and banked on working with Pochettino, their coach, on developing players, on making their current group better than spending money on John Duran and spending just resources trying to sign John Duran in any form this window. I don't get it. I don't get it. And I like him. As I say, I will back this up by saying I quite like him. And again, like if you have to say in the summer that Breuer goes and you're signed to Ram, well, I think it's a little bit stupid, and it is a flaw in the way that the system's working, because you've spent all this time and energy to develop Breuer, to give him a pathway, to send him on loans, to pay him the wages, to offer him the contract, just to sell him. That's flawed, and that is not just the Chelsea problem. That's a Premier League problem. That's a PSR problem for right now, which has to be tackled at some point before it becomes stupid, right? Before Arsenal start selling Smith Rowe to buy Kean and Dewsbury Hall and stuff like that, you know, like that. I digress. That is a little bit outside of the question, but that is sort of the long and short of it. And I hope this isn't something that we just sort of have to start accepting as football fans, that this is the system, this is how it's going to be with American investors. But I fear it might be.
Yeah, I wonder how far away we are from at youth level going, you sign for that academy, and in a few years we'll spend 25 million and we'll bring you back to Chelsea because it's better for us financially. It's,
What was
yeah,
it people used to
crazy
say
world.
when Arsenal signed a player, and it was, oh, look forward to him signing for Man City in 5 years. And it's actually getting to a stage where that's actually the real thing. Like, should have sent
Oh.
Cole to Man City so we could buy him for 50 million in a couple of years' time.
Oh dear, yeah, no, exactly. It's, yeah, Dean, yeah, it was just a bizarre link. As I said, may well be a decent player, doesn't move the needle. It's literally just player trading, and you know, for us, financially beneficial to probably try and do it, but again, doesn't really actual in terms of the things that actually fans care about. It has basically zero
How
positive
do you get
net
attached to players?
impact.
How do you get attached to players when you think this might be it? Is every player is sort of sellable? If you think Malo Gusto is a 20-year-old right back, well, if he has a good couple of years and a big bid comes in, Chelsea will sell him and try and get the next Malo Gusto. How do you ever get connected to those players if you think that might be what comes up?
Next question and final question comes in from RJ. Hey lads, thoughts on the approach Poch deployed, pros and cons, and what do you think he learned from this ahead of Liverpool? I'll go to the second part. What do you, because I think this is the easy part. What do you think he learned from his head of Liverpool? Tom, I'm kind of wary of doing this because I think, like, we had a question when you were last on, like, could from us, it was like, could it be a stepping stone? And we were like, probably not, because this is Chelsea. And what do you think he learned? I kind of replied to Sosima. I don't think he learned a lot. I think he knew that he's got, you know, some good starters. Like, he's got his almost like some core good starters, and then what he has off the bench is perhaps not quite, you know, that level, which we kind of saw last night. I don't necessarily think he learned loads about it. He maybe learned a bit more about Alfie Gilchrist, seeing how he handled himself, you know, against the toughest opposition he's faced so far. But I don't know what I we'll go on to be on. Part of the question first, but I don't necessarily think he learned a huge amount about last night from Liverpool. Like, he knew Chelsea have still at times got issues in front of goal, right? He already knew that. I don't necessarily know how much he learned from last night.
I think last night showed development in a way that we haven't seen in recent weeks, because practically since, even you go back to like the Sheffield United game, where the first half was really quite drab and poor. I know people were overreacted. We were a bit more calm about the situation. Preston the same. I think last night was the best performance Chelsea have had in a 65-minute spell, as I say, since Arsenal, and in a very different way. So I think it was good in that way, that Chelsea actually put out a strong performance against a strong team, because a lot of this recent run has come against, I mean, what have you got? You've got three games in there against Championship opposition, some lower league side. You've got Luton, Crystal Palace, Sheffield United, stuff like that. Chelsea haven't really done anything in this run. They've been sort of good enough, which is good, because Chelsea haven't always been good enough in the past 18 months. But I think this shows once again that Chelsea can go toe to toe, can compete with, and can cause problems to the best teams in the league, which will undoubtedly be needed for Liverpool. Chelsea, if they want to get anything, will have to be better in front of goal, and they won't be able to give Liverpool the sort of chances that they did against Aston Villa. But I do think it showed that Chelsea can compete, can do this, can make a fight of it, and that's what I said at the start of the season that I wanted from this season. And progress has almost certainly been made. I think perhaps Pochettino knows now more than ever the maybe a group of maybe 14 players that he can trust, and I mean, one of them's Reece James, who's injured. One of them's Christopher Nkunku, who's injured. Like Madueke, maybe he's starting to trust a bit more, but he's still a little bit too rogue to start games. I'd be very surprised if Madueke starts against Liverpool, because I don't think you can be that forgiving. I don't think you can be as forgiving as Madueke needs to be in the final third. He's creative. He's nice. He solves problems. He's really neat and exciting, but he's not going to punish you. And Chelsea need players, I think, on Wednesday night against Liverpool, like Sterling, like Palmer. Ha, I'm saying Sterling like he's, some prolific sort of forward. But you need those people that you sort of trust can actually finish the chance when they come to them. And I think now more than ever, Pochettino knows who those players are. He knows it's Palmer. He knows it's Gallagher. And I think, again, this is nothing particularly new. We've known it for a little while. But yesterday, really, for the first time in a couple of months, Chelsea played against a team that were going to cause them problems, and Chelsea hit back and responded with problems of their own. And I think that's a positive sign. But that with Crystal Palace, Wolves on the horizon, it could just as well mean nothing after that, in a couple of weeks' time.
Yep, indeed. And I said, as for Liverpool, you mentioned, Palmer. So I reckon Breyer will probably start. I think that I don't see him going a second game in a row without a recognised number nine, even if Breyer himself has faults and will no doubt be probably subbed off at some point, having probably not done a whole lot more. As I said, I reckon you'll see Chilwell start at left back. The question will be if Colwell's fit enough to start, and I think he obviously comes in for Badiashile, and we'll kind of see the same back line we saw against Middlesbrough. Petrovic will be in goal. I think Gallagher will be in midfield. It'll be Enzo and Caicedo with Gallagher, and then it will be Palmer, Sterling and Breuer front three. I think that's what we will see. I don't see a world where Mudryk starts, given what we've seen of him against Borough and against Villa, even if I actually think that Villa game perhaps would have been better suited for him to start than, say, the Borough game. And Nonny, I don't actually think he's really done anything wrong for a while now. He got a goal. He was good when he came on against Borough. He was all right yesterday. He's been in general pretty good, I think, this last month. But I just don't think he will start against Liverpool. I think it will be Palmer. It will be Sterling out wide, and I think it will be Breyer up top.
Agreed.
Anyway, that's a side point.
And I think that actually gives you better options than the bench. I think that gives you,
Yeah.
if you want to take off Breuer and play Palmer centrally, if you want to bring on Chukwuemeka, Mudryk's a better sub, Madueke's a better sub at the moment. I think that, and we saw that against Middlesbrough, we've seen it against Preston, and we've seen that in league games as well recently. I think that is the better way to go at the moment.
Yeah, indeed. And Tom, as for RJ's first part of the question, thoughts on the approach Poch deployed, pros and cons? I mean, I said he was kind of hamstrung with what he could select, in terms of, I said, because I thought, I said, one of the pros was considering that we had four centre backs out there on the pitch. And I think, and as much as we have been frustrated with Levi Colwill at left back, we would also say that we definitely think he offers more as a fullback than either go in an attacking sense than either a Badiashile or an Alfie Gilchrist, right? As much as he can frustrate, we don't think it's the best position for him. We have seen, particularly in the games against Fulham this year, Levi Colwill's impact actually as a left back. So I actually think, Tom, one of the pros last night was the fact we had four centre backs on the pitch, and we were still able to be relatively decent creatively, even if some of those chances did also come from Middlesbrough, from not Middlesbrough, from Aston Villa, giving the ball away. But I did think, that was good. I thought defensively we were fairly good. Obviously, there were a couple of times on in transition, we did get potentially caught out a little bit, but I thought that was good. And as said, as you mentioned, I think at the start of it, our pressing last night was really, really good. As said, we caused Villa a lot of problems and caused them to give the ball away, in dangerous areas. I thought that press last night was really, really on it. And as said, as for cons to the approach Poch had, obviously, I think we maybe talked about it, the lack of a focal point. There were times when we put crosses into the box and it was just easy for Martinez to gather because there was no one there to get on the end of it. But in terms of like the lineup and who we had available, I probably do have more pros and cons with that performance, because that was actually, I was relatively encouraged with that performance given the personnel we had out there against that quality of opposition as well, but we were still able to produce a fairly solid performance.
Yeah, I don't really have much to add. I think it is sort of what we discussed earlier, the catch 22 of the striker, the system he went with created the chances, but the system that he created wasn't able to finish the chances. And in this Chelsea team at the moment, you can't really have both because they don't have a player that is both able to be part of this creative and pressing unit, but also finish the chances. That the closest thing they have to that is Cole Palmer. Cole Palmer had an off day. Doesn't happen. It's happened twice basically since he arrived. So I think it would be undeserving to be too critical of that. And I was really impressed actually by that defence and how well it played. I mean, you're not going to get that group of players playing in that system very often this season. So to have that and to adapt so late against a really strong outfit that tests you, I thought was mightily impressive. Villa test teams in certain ways. You know, that midfield, I know Tielemans hasn't played loads, but Douglas Luiz, John McGinn, they're really tenacious players. And I think the Chelsea midfield, it was a really, really good battle in there. Don't remember the Villa wingers doing too much. It was, you know, sort of Matty Cash cut inside for the big chance, and Watkins caused problems like Watkins does. But I don't think that, you know, players like Diaby, Bailey, when he came on, didn't really cause Chelsea that many issues. And I think those problems were sort of came from fatigue and fitness. And again, that's impacted by the injuries that Chelsea have right now, because in an ideal world, Chelsea wouldn't have had to have gone as strong against Middlesbrough. They wouldn't have had to have gone as strong here against Villa. But there isn't really depth to this. And if you do get to the stage where you are starting, you know, you're already starting Gilchrist, and if you're starting Mudryk as well and Madueke, and you're sort of thinking, well, who do we actually rely on in this team? And you need to have those thoughts of players. So I'd be very hesitant of being critical of the system that Chelsea played at all yesterday, because I think it helped them more than it hindered them.
Yeah. Also, RJ, till Cole's got injury, I was gonna one of my prayers would have been one keep from the bench. That was truly
Yes,
wonderful to see. And then
absolutely.
Cole gets injured and a second keeper gets added to the bench. Short lived. But yeah, no, I said the thing is, I'm fairly positive about Nice. It's just a sense of like a bit of a missed opportunity. The fact he goes back to Villa Park and it's just another game that none of us really want to watch. That's perhaps why there's just a bit of that mixed feeling. But in terms of actually looking at that performance as a whole, if that was a Premier League game against Aston Villa and we'd drawn that 0-0, we'd be pretty positive about that result and, you know, be fairly happy and we'd be saying, you know, nice things. And we have said some good things about this performance moving forward. Tom, before we go, obviously, since the last episode, Chelsea have found out their Carabao Cup final opponents. It is Liverpool again. Chelsea will meet Liverpool again in a domestic cup final. It's happened quite a lot in the 21st century. And Tom, that news is probably, I don't know, Chelsea's task was made a bit harder. Oh, okay, well, depends how people view it. With the news that Jurgen Klopp is stepping down from Liverpool. Now, we're not, this is a Chelsea podcast, so we're not going to talk about, you know, the amazing work Jurgen Klopp has done at Liverpool, etc., how brilliant he is. You know, if you want that, you can, you know, I mean, it's been inundated on your social media through or from whatever TV channel you watch, Sky, TNT, etc. You've had it rammed down your throat and you don't want that here. But Tom, thoughts, because a lot of people, and me included, probably makes the Carabao Cup final a tiny bit harder. You've got a Liverpool team going full pelt, wanting to try and make history and make this last season truly memorable. And then there's that tiny part of me that goes, well, Chelsea are quite good at spoiling parties and kind of ruining the narrative and doing that. You know, you think about Chelsea and Wenger's 1,000th game, you think about, you know, Chelsea, you know, helping Leicester win the title by that game against Tottenham. And I guess another example, even if I don't think it's a very good example, but you did people if people remember this, when Manchester City announced that Manuel Pellegrini was leaving in his final season, Pep Guardiola taking over, Manchester City did drop off a lot and then eventually, you know, just scraped into the top four at the end. But there was one point where City could easily have been, say, going for a title that season, but then they just did fall off quite a bit. Tom, there's obviously the chance that, you know, it could just kill those Liverpool players. You know, maybe especially some of those players that have signed this season, given that they'd have thought, oh, you know, working with Klopp is going to be a long time. But also, you know, you think it would just also fuel a bit more. Just thoughts, where do you stand on this? It was already a tough task, but it just feels like it's got a whole lot more difficult. And again, that also then just links back to Wednesday, the first Premier League game at Anfield with them going for a Premier League title since the news broke.
I'm slightly more worried about Wednesday immediately, because I think that there will be a big reaction. Liverpool, I've been a lot more pro Liverpool than pro Arsenal this season, despite their sort of similar-ish positions in the table. And I've been backing Liverpool quite a way. I can see Liverpool basically going really close to winning the quadruple this season. Hopefully we can nip that in the bud pretty quickly in a month's time. Chelsea will be underwhelming underdogs for that game, but I have real hope that Chelsea can, you just want them to compete, right? And Hopefully, a seed of doubt can be planted in the heads of Liverpool, that Chelsea can really cause them problems, and hopefully that comes on Wednesday night. And I think that Chelsea will cause Liverpool problems. They might not win the game, they might lose the game, but I want them to cause problems. I wouldn't be surprised if Liverpool went and won three or four trophies this season. I know that the flip side to that is that I think Klopp did this before at Dortmund and it sort of backfired. Ferguson did it 20 odd years ago and it backfired before retiring. He deliberately didn't tell people he was leaving before Man United won the league in his last season and stuff like that. I just think Jurgen Klopp is so good in this sense, that it will really add fire to Liverpool, to be honest. But cup finals in particular, I think it's too unpredictable. It's too much of a one-off to make the difference. I don't think Klopp leaving Liverpool at the end of the season is going to be the difference between Chelsea and Liverpool in that cup final, particularly. That will come down to a quality thing. I think it will make more of a difference in the league, where over whatever it is, 17 games, this could give Liverpool the edge on their opponents. And that doesn't really impact Chelsea that much. All I can say is he definitely hasn't been the same since Frank Lampard got in his face at Anfield in 2020. So
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And I said, Pep, if you're listening, mate, if you want to bounce anytime soon, feel free as well, man. Jürgen's leaving. You come back. You could go with him too. That'd be nice. You two can go and chill. No, honestly, the narrative, obviously, the narrative. The Europa League is one trophy Liverpool haven't won. So if they're to win one trophy, then I'll allow him a Europa League, folks. You know, Pep, I need you to try extra hard to win this Premier League and deny Liverpool that. And then obviously Chelsea can hopefully do the business
And then
in the Carabao Cup final, but you
that
know, the
will.
Europa League, it's one trophy, it's not one. So I'll begrudgingly allow you that one, Jurgen, to go. So your story goes full circle.
If
But
Klopp can
yeah.
leave with one Premier League title, that would absolutely end any Klopp over Mourinho talk as well. Which, not to sound too blasphemous, I think there is potentially scope for it being in the conversation if he was to win a second. I know he'd have one less than Mourinho, but I think given what he's also done at Liverpool and the sort of building job he did, I think you could actually sort of put him in that conversation. But if he ends with one Premier League title, even against this Pep Guardiola team, I think you go, Mourinho was better, man. But I hate those sorts of conversations. But it would give Chelsea fans real ammunition.
And as I said, Chelsea fans already have the ammunition they need. Nizar Kinsella kind of did that yesterday of his tweet that, you know, Chelsea basically been as successful as Liverpool in this Klopp era.
Absolutely.
Obviously the Carabao Cup final can help, you know, turn that the other way, etc. But yeah, the fact that Chelsea been as successful as Liverpool in this Klopp era, despite being highly dysfunctional. I would say though, I probably would rather have, you know, this won't be the most popular thing to say, but I probably would have rather done it the Liverpool way. It probably would have
Yes,
been a bit
I
more
so, so
enjoyable.
I yeah, I would
Chelsea
rather be
fans
finishing
probably won't admit this. Chelsea fans
second,
won't admit
third,
it because they kind of
second.
go, they like thrive on the chaos aspect of it. But I'll be honest, I'd have killed to have like a relationship with a manager as long as Liverpool fans have had with Klopp, and to just have that feeling of just. Yeah, because let's be honest, we've loved Chelsea winning the trophies and it's been great, but how many of those seasons have we also just been thoroughly depressed or distraught at a manager going or just something happening and just being like and just feeling so apathetic to it? Like before Tuchel came in and won the Champions League, how depressed were lots of us? I will say lots of us because obviously there were some people who were delighted when Frank left, but how depressed were lots of us when Frank got sacked and we thought, oh, the world is over, we've lost our football club, etc. How You know, and then how sad were lots of people again when Tuchel went, and how like, anyway, this is a side point. We've rambled on, and it's a good sign to wrap things up. But yeah, it's you know, hopefully Chelsea can spoil a party, which you know they have been known to do, but have also not done it for a while. You know, Jurgen, we helped your team win the Premier League when we beat City 2-1 in lockdown. So you know, you kind of owe us one. So leave the Carabao to us, please.
You
But
can't
no,
win
we
two.
wait
You
and see.
can't win
That will
two cup
wrap
finals
it
on
up for.
penalties. You can't do that. Come on, right? But they owe us one it like that. Like cup, we won't have Kepa. Look at the positives. There won't be any Kepa.
Yeah, there's no Kepa who has been involved in Chelsea's last two penalty shootout defeats in the Carabao Cup final. Yeah, there's no oh God, him being subbed on as a penalty specialist to then proceed to concede all 11 penalties and then miss his kick is but just depressing. It was also like depressing is the fact that then Tuchel basically learned the following shootout. I was like, Mendy's not a great penalty stopper, but Kepa is scar me. I'm keeping Mendy on him. Yeah, no, hopefully none of that again. Who
And we let Tsimikas win a trophy against us with the Final kick. Why have to be him? He's crap.
What's still great? What's still great to me is about Van Dijk punting the Carabao Cup final. Kepa literally tells him where to put it. He puts it there, and it still goes in. And it's just like, Kepa, mate, honestly. No, I'm haunted. I'm haunted because I look at the Chelsea players who took penalties in that shootout. How was off his Timo Werner scored his penalty, folks. There was a strong chance a lot of us thought he was missing. Romelu Lukaku scored his penalty. Strong chance, strong narrative. He was missing. Trevor Chalobah scored his penalty. Thiago Silva scored his penalty. But no, Kepa could not save one penalty out of 11. Anyway, I'm still annoyed. That also, side point, that also day has basically ruined Dua Lipa's One Kiss for me. I can never listen to
Oh,
that song
God.
again because I was in Wembley waiting to go out and that was blaring over the speakers because Liverpool, as they do, have adopted that song and it was just going in my ears and I was like, I want to get out of here. I'm miserable. I've watched Chelsea dominate and batter Liverpool, somehow not score. Cheers, Mason Mount as well for that. And then lose on penalties because Kepa, who was brought on to do the one thing he's meant to be good at, could not do that. But anyway, we are really rambling now and it is late. It's been, a fun episode to record of a podcast, even if Chelsea, have not progressed in the cup. They are still in the cup, and by the next episode we will know who Chelsea could potentially face in the FA Cup as well. So we'll wait to see what happens there. Tom, it's been a pleasure having you on, my man. Give yourself one last plug where people can find you and all your stuff.
Thank you very much, Nick. As always, it's been a pleasure. And I think we've managed to go on for long enough about a game that ultimately ended 0-0. You can find me at Tom Coley 49 on Twitter for the cricket and the football shit posting, and also anything written in longer form out on football.london and across some of the other Reach sites, Manchester Evening News and Liverpool Echo, in the coming weeks and months as well.
Lovely, lovely stuff. Tom's links will be in the description below. And as you said, if you want to, gauge the mood and the feel of an England cricket fan and how much they believe that, how much hope this England team are giving them in the first test against India and whether or not they can pull it off. And then you want to see how long that hope is there for before India inevitably get off to a flyer and knock whatever this run chase is off. But hey, I woke up this Saturday to record the podcast and England is still in the test match, is still back. So this Saturday has already gone better than I expected. So that is very, very nice. And it's the holdovers later at the cinema. Paul Giamatti, looking forward to seeing that. Anyway, as for us, you can find us on Twitter or X at ThatChelseaPod, Instagram, ThatChelseaPod, and all your usual podcast platform providers, Apple, Spotify, Google, etc. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please feel free to leave a rating and a review whenever I tweet a pod. Any likes and reposts go a long way. And if you want to repost a pod, it helps us get onto other people's timelines. Yeah, it was a frustrating Friday evening. At Stamford Bridge against Aston Villa, resulting in an extra game that nobody wants, but there were positives to take. We also kind of learned, that Chelsea still have those same flaws and probably aren't really going to go anytime soon. But we've got another tie against Aston Villa to look forward to. But we'll be back next week to look back at Chelsea's trip to Anfield. So until then, keep the blue flag flying high.
Chelsea nil, Villa nil. Got to go to Birmingham and do it all over again. How Martinez has kept two clean sheets at the Bridge now this season is absolutely beyond me. Why do we keep hitting it low to the guy? You hit it low to him, he's going to save it. Just everything was low at him again, like the first game against them. To be honest, I just knew it wasn't going to be our day the second Palmer took that touch of an elephant when he was 1-1. But yeah, performance is good. I think Petrovic is really putting a case now for number one. With some cracking saves again last night. And special mention to Douglas Luiz, who tried conning everyone by punching the ball in the net, which I thought was the most blatant handball of the night, which somehow the officials missed, which summed up their performance. Anyway, Scousers on midweek. After the Klopp news, that should be a whole lot of fun, shouldn't it?
Sports Social Podcast Network.